From the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff at the Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting WILL AM 580. Today's broadcast is made possible in part by the U of I's Center for Advanced Study, whose Millercom 2005 lecture series presents Family, Gender, and State in the Middle East and South Asia by Suad Joseph, Department of Anthropology, University of California at Davis, on Thursday, October 8th at 7:30 p.m. on the third floor of the Levis Faculty Center on the U of I campus. For more information, go to www.cas.uiuc.edu.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning telephone talk show. My name is Jack Brighton, sitting in for your regular host, David Inge, for the last time for a while. Probably Dave will be back tomorrow. Anyway, glad you're listening. With us during this hour, Larry Lister. He is an energy efficiency engineer with Facility Dynamics Engineering. And we're going to talk about home energy during this hour, something we do every once in a while. Taking your questions, if you'd like to call in and talk with Larry Lister, you can do so. We'll talk about how you can make your home more comfy while getting more out of your energy dollar and the various things you can do to accomplish that. And all you have to do is pick up the telephone and call us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line anywhere you hear us, 800-222-9455. Your questions are welcome. Good morning, Larry.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Let's talk about John Lee Anderson's book some more.
Oh,
that was fascinating.
I guess there was a connection with energy, you know, there.
Oh, boy, that's a slippery slope.
Yeah, I think so, probably. Well, let me quickly mention then that I turned on our furnace for the first time last night.
Oh, yeah.
And thankfully it came.
I did in August in my house. I actually did. I had, for the first time ever, I think, I had to turn the boiler on for about 3 days in August. It was just got too silly.
I don't remember, but I'm sure you're right. It might have dipped down. But thankfully, it came on, you know.
That's always a good thing.
Yeah, definitely.
Didn't blow up.
Yeah. Good. But the point being that this is the time when people are going to start to go, oh, I better check that out. Mm-hmm. I better start thinking about battening down the hatches and so forth. So any sort of three-point plan that people should sort of embark on to get started?
Three-point plan. That's the political,
about a five-year,
the political season.
A five-year plan? No.
I have a four-point plan for this. Yeah. Well, it's the standard thing. First of all, it's, you know, at some point you're going to want to close your windows, although a lot of people don't even open their windows anymore. I'm not sure why that is. Mine are always wide open, sometimes even when I have the heat on, just because I like the fresh air. But, the first thing you want to do is just, this is the thing we always harp about this time of year, is always good to you know, get the furnace going and have a nice, efficient furnace if you're getting ready to buy a new one. You know, do your homework. We can talk about what that means. Mm-hmm. But the thing that everybody seems to forget about is the fact that if you want to reduce the amount of energy your furnace needs to make, you need to look at the building shell, and houses are built to stand up and not fall down in a storm. They're not so much built to hold in the thermal energy, which is insulation, although we do a pretty good job insulating our houses. The thing that we don't do a very good job is sealing the house shell, and the builders don't really pay a lot of attention to it. They sometimes give it a little bit of lip service, and some are better than others. But there's a lot of air being sucked into and out of your walls that you can't see or feel, and it's due to little glitches in the construction. You know, where the porch roof ties into a house sometimes is a great big old hole up inside in the structure. There's all kinds of just little areas where if you're even remotely handy, you can go around and do some pretty nice air sealing and keep that cold air from being sucked in. What causes that to happen is when our furnaces are running, sometimes we make lower pressure parts inside our house, and that tends to cause air to be drawn in. But more often than not, it's due to environmental things, weather, wind blowing over the house. There's a high pressure side and a low pressure side of your house when the wind's blowing, and all this stuff kind of gets sucked in. Our bodies are good at feeling temperature. We're pretty sensitive temperature sensors. We're not very good at pressure, unless the result of a pressure difference is wind. And unless you feel that breeze, you know, near the windows or something, unless you feel that breeze, and there usually has to have a temperature difference associated with it before you feel it, you sort of don't know it's there. And so we have this, this cold air in the winter being kind of sucked into our wall cavities, and it's blowing around in our attics and things, and we kind of don't, it's out of sight, out of mind. The furnace knows about it, you know, because it all gets taken care of eventually, and you see it when you pay your bill. So that's the area that tends to get short shrift as far as being dealt with as an energy thing. The other piece of the puzzle that is also kind of a big unknown, but it's where a lot of the sins occur in our efficiency in our houses, is the ductwork. Everybody worries about, I want to make sure I'm insulated, and then they worry about whether they have an efficient furnace. Well, the link between the two is the ductwork, and a lot of times it's really not in good shape. And it's something that if you call somebody out to the house to work on the house, you should look into having them check out the ductwork for any major problems or leaks. A lot of newer homes have this flexible duct, kind of slinky type stuff, which I don't like for a lot of reasons. It deteriorates. It doesn't last very long. It's not a very sustainable type way to build, but it's sure cheap. And you know, a lot of people have that kind of stuff, and you know, squirrels get in the attic, mice get in the attic, stuff chews through it, and that can really impact a lot of your heating bills and heating dollars. So that's another area that I try to keep reminding people to focus on that, and talk to your furnace technician when you do have them out, and just see what's going on. A lot of times where the duct connects to the wall and blows out the register is a common weak spot where somebody just slaps a register up to make it look good, and there's a big gap in there, and it's blowing, 80% of your heat's blowing up inside your wall, and you don't know it, and what you're getting is only 20%. You don't know the difference, but that kind of stuff's pretty common.
Well, we'll follow up on some of those points. We do have a caller to talk with. Let's include them, and we'll go first to an Indiana caller, line number 4. Good morning.
Hello. You started out with the sort of questions I was going to ask. I have three elderly ladies, relatives, who live in older houses. They're not insulated, and they have gravity-fed furnaces. And they've come to me and asked me, what should they do to help save some money this year because of the cost of natural gas has gone up in my area here in Indiana.
Yeah.
And the first things I've thought of, things I've seen in the past, people putting plastic over the windows and using that sort of clay-like ribbon to inside the windows. And then there's the question about how far should I turn down the furnace at night and things like that. All the information I've found so far normally assumes that somebody has, an up-to-date furnace and in the ducting you talked about. I found one of those situations and got it corrected. But everything else it seems to be, I've checked one furnace of my aunt, and the duct worked just fine, and everything's working properly there. It's just a question of what are some of the things you can do for people who don't have, contemporary situation. And there probably is a lot of people like that out there in the listening office audience, perhaps. I don't know. But I would certainly like any information you could give, any sort of hints or about the windows, what you can do, whether you should just shut off a room that's not used much, things along that line.
Sure.
Now, most of the homes have ceiling fans in the largest rooms, to distribute the hotter air up downward so that there is that kind of flow. But that's about all I know about it, and they've been bugging me the last month. And I talked to Mr. Spees, who's a home inspector, and he gave some information, and I thought perhaps you could give some more information that would be helpful. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, first off, I'll say that you know a lot, so that's nice to hear. Yeah, there's there's a bunch of stuff in there, and I'll try to remember all of it. The first issue, the good one that the caller points out, is that there's a lot of these really old gravity-fed furnaces. And what that means for those of you that aren't familiar is that the good news about those things is that they last forever. The bad news is that they last forever. And a gravity-fed furnace is, this is old technology, and it's basically a big old can in the basement with a bonfire in it. And it's not a very efficient bonfire, but it's a big old bonfire. And then there's all these, the ductwork all rises and slopes up so that the heat just naturally rises and pours out into the house, and the cold air naturally kind of falls down and goes back to the furnace. It is a very inefficient combustion and delivery process, but it's very robust. There's not a whole lot that can go wrong in those things, and so they tend to go years and years and years without any attention. At some point, they do go. You know, the heat exchanger is going to eventually go, and at that point, you need to do something. And so, I would say, just as a matter of course, the first thing to really be looking into is the upgrade to a newer technology. To a forced air furnace that's got a fan that is going to be a lot smaller. You're going to get a lot of basement room back when you put one of these in, and you'll save a fair bit of money. Those gravity furnaces, a lot of them are probably on the order of 50% efficiency, and if you go to something that's a 90% plus the sort of tried and true new technologies, which are in my opinion and almost everybody else is pretty tried and true at this point. You can save on for every $1,000 you spend for heating in the winter, whatever that means in your house. If you're going from a 50 to a 90, you're going to save about 44%, if I can do the math in my head. And so that's $400 out of 1,000. And that's not trivial. That kind of thing can pay back, especially if you got these big old furnaces with these houses that are a big house that's got a big bill. So that I would say that's the first thing that I'd want to address. The caller also mentions windows, which is a common topic for the fall show here, and windows are they're definitely an issue, and I advise people against this plastic thing. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you're doing something. But we all feel cold air near windows. The reason we feel cold air near windows isn't always solely due to the window. I talked about how cold air gets sucked into the wall areas and things, and a lot of us have cold air moving through our walls even if we have insulation in there, because insulation doesn't hold up to air pressure changes. It's merely a thermal barrier. And what happens is a lot of times the cold air that's coming in our walls just happens to find its way out in the connection between the window and the wall, in that construction detail between the window and the wall. So sometimes you're getting this cold air that's finding its way out around the window trim, and we say, oh, this window's leaky. I'm gonna block off the window, and actually you're sort of putting a Band-Aid on the problem and not a very effective one at that. A lot of people say, well, I want to buy new windows, and you get phone calls from people at dinner time all the time wanting to sell you new windows because of their energy efficiency. However, again, a lot of people put these really nice efficient windows in and their bill doesn't change nearly like they expect it to, because the other 80-90% of their wall area, which is solid and not window, is still really leaky. And they're kind of thinking, what happened? I put these efficient windows on. Yeah, well, you got, you just made an efficient barrier at 10% of your house and not the rest. Now, there's a lot of good reasons to have new windows, mainly to open them and, get fresh air and have nice light and things. So that's kind of my take on the windows, is we all focus on the windows, and I think it's not quite always the way to go. Now, that said, if you've got leaks and things and the windows are old and you can't rebuild them, which old houses, the windows are really fairly easy to rebuild, and they're made to come apart and they're made to take some maintenance. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of one of the nice things about them, although a lot of people tend to just want to tear them out and put new ones in. So a little bit of cheap quick weather stripping is fine, but boy, it's real. I see these folks putting plastic up on their windows, and then when the wind blows. The one nice thing is it teaches you all about this pressure thing I was talking about, because the best way to learn about how much pressure forces are being put on your house is to put a big piece of plastic in front of the window and hear it go boom, boom, as it fills up with air and sucks air out. Because mm-hmm. when the wind blows, you hear these things, they fill up, and it's a nice indicator of what's really going on. And the rest of your walls are experiencing that, only they're letting the air in. So I really advise against, in most cases, there's always an exception, but in most cases, the plastic is way more expensive and way more work than you're really going to get out of it.
We're talking this morning about home energy, taking your questions. Larry Lister is our guest. He's an engineer with Facility Dynamics Engineering. And if you would like to talk with him, all you have to do is pick up the telephone. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else you hear us, 800-222-9455. So what are some of the methods you would go about finding those little leaks in the walls? I mean, you take a candle up or, you know.
That's good. Yeah. That's a good one, yeah. The first thing is to kind of note where the big infractions exist. And the infractions, the places where a lot of this leaking occurs is low and high. So it's not so much, you know, in the middle of the wall where the siding is or anything, although those can have problems too. But down where the wood frame of the house meets the concrete, it's like the rock and the hard place. And nowadays in efficient construction, people put gaskets down so they have a concrete, which is not a really smooth, regular surface. They put kind of a foam gasket and then they drop the wood on there and tighten it down. So you get a really nice seal. Well, for 100 years, we didn't do that kind of thing. And down at the band joist and where all the framing kind of comes together down low near the ground or just above the ground, a lot of those places are areas where there happen to be a lot of leakage sites, and depending on how accessible it is, usually it's from the basement. Sometimes coming in with urethane, there's these guys that will spray urethane, which is a really good air sealer and a really good insulator in the right applications, and they can hit all those pockets pretty quickly and somewhat cost effectively. It doesn't always look great, but if you don't care. Or if you're going to cover it up, you know, that works out pretty well. So down low, there's those kinds of places. The high places in the house are the penetrations that go through your conditioned space, wherever that happens to be, into the attic, which may or may not be part of the conditioned space, and then out the roof. So you've got penetrations for vents, you know, plumbing vents, chimneys, and places like that. There's often a lot of big areas there that can be sealed. If you're kind of a do-it-yourselfer and you're looking for some of these places, the thing to do is go look when it's really cold, so you can really feel what's going on. And depending on, you know, I knew a guy that did this work for the Army years ago, and in cold climates he would take a bucket of water and he'd stick his arm in the water, and then and use that as a way to determine, you know, so he could really feel where the cold air was, and he'd stick his hand in, you know, down around the basement, and he would use that as a sort of a low tech way of determining it. The other way to do it is put a blower door on and just suck the house, make the house really negative, cause the outside air to come in, and then go looking for it. That's the high tech way of doing it.
Interesting.
But yeah, those the low and high are the places to kind of look, and then there's always these major big openings where porches are a really common one, where the porch connects into the framing of the house. A porch roof is not at all very tight, not made to be tight. It's just made, you know, usually put the ceiling on the porch just for looks. You know, this cold air goes right up in there, and then a lot of times it goes right into your house, and you don't know it because it's all been covered up. So there's things like that too, but usually some of the good insulation contractors can address this. One other thing that people should do if they don't have insulation is blown cellulose is a really cost-effective and fairly easy way to add insulation to a house that doesn't already have it. And there's somebody actually here in Champaign that I just heard is doing dense-packed cellulose, where they run a tube up the wall and fill it with cellulose, but they fill it really tight. And the reason being to try to stop this pressure thing, this air being sucked in and out, and they try to make a pressure barrier as well as a temperature barrier, because a lot of times in most houses those are two different places and they really should be coincidental if you can do it.
Our lines are all full, so let's go ahead and talk with some callers. So we'll go next to someone in Belgium on line number 4. Good morning.
Sir, I was hoping to ask you a little bit more esoteric question. In the there seems to be some better ways to heat our houses and utilize the energy that comes to our houses by using the energy more than one time, namely like using a fuel cell possibly to generate electricity for your house, but also generate heat, mm-hmm. hot water, and many other uses all at the same time. Do you have any discussions about that, newer technologies?
Philosophically is right on. It's a great point, and I think that at some point, I don't think it's as far in the future as a lot of people would say. I think that kind of thing is going to be more and more available. There's actually a lot of fuel cell work that is done here in Champaign-Urbana is kind of a little hotbed of fuel cell research. There's some folks both at the university, there's a couple private sector spinoffs, and at the Army Corps of Engineers Construction Research Lab. I think that's going to happen. The market bears all of this, of course, and until the prices are such that people are willing to do it, it's gonna be kind of an esoteric thing. But the market has a way of making things work. We're seeing wind turbines all over the place right now. It's awesome. I love it.
Yeah.
So things happen, faster sometimes than we think they're going to.
Would you have some sort of direction to send a person who's looking into that?
Ooh,
in a kind of a an email type thing or internet type thing.
Well, if you get online, that's probably the best way to start researching any of this. Is just hit Google and look for residential fuel cell would be one way I would probably get started looking for that sort of thing. The Construction Engineering Research Lab, you might actually be able to call their switchboard and ask to talk to any of the fuel cell people. I could give you the name of one guy that's working on that, and I've been out of there for quite a while. So, but I do know there's one of the researchers is named Frank Holcomb, out at the Corps of Engineers. Mike Binder is another guy.
Well, I'll try to look into it.
Yeah, either of those guys have their heads to the ground, and they know the whole lay of the land really well, and they could give you a lot better, service.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
Thanks for the call. So the notion that I've read about in Wired magazine, at least, is that we'll have a fuel cell. Well, at least in one scenario, you got a fuel cell powered car that runs on hydrogen, basically. Is that right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then when you park it in your garage at night, you plug it into your house and it powers everything.
Mm-hmm. And the waste is water.
Yeah.
It's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
It's almost like a perpetual motion machine, but it's not. It's sound physics.
Yeah. So, this sounds like a future scenario, but you say it's maybe not that far off?
Well, I don't think so. And I'm definitely not the expert. This isn't an area that I've been able to keep up on, unfortunately. There's too many interesting things out there. But what I do see and what crosses my desk and just, in reading, mostly in just reading popular literature, not really the technical literature, is that, they're just making all kinds of progress on fuel cells and on energy storage, other energy storage technologies, which is a real key for renewables, is that the problem we have with renewables is the wind only blows when the wind blows, and we need electricity seemingly all the time. And with solar photovoltaics, it's pretty easy to see when it's going to be enough light to make electricity, but what do we do at night? And they're looking into a lot more ways of trying to store. If we could just find efficient ways to store electricity so that we could use it whenever we need it, then we could handle renewables in a lot better fashion. We're far from having to worry about it, because right now if you got a wind turbine and it's making electricity, there's not enough wind turbines out there yet. Somebody needs the electricity, so it mm-hmm. can pretty much always be used. But
well, we'll go
be a nice problem to have.
Yeah,
to get to the point of how we're going to save the rest of this renewable stuff that we're making when we don't need it.
Several callers remain on hold here. We'll go next to a listener in Chicago on line number one. Good morning.
Good morning. Some people seem to think they have to have fresh air, and they open the windows, even though regardless of the temperature. These negative and positive ion things, if you had one of those in your air conditioning unit or your ventilating, would that clean up that air?
Boy, sure. Those technologies are really good for, especially for pulling out particulates if there's a smoker in the house or something.
Cooking odor,
candles. Candles are horribly dirty. If you're an air pollution person, candles all of a sudden become quite not so romantic, and you see them as a pretty inefficient.
How large a unit would you need on an ordinary home mounted with a ventilating system?
Well, it really depends on the size. It's something that is sized for the furnace. So if you get an HVAC technician into heating technician and to look at it, they'll just look at the furnace, they look at the duct, and that's how that pretty much determines the.
Are they in use as of this moment? That system?
Yes, they're not. I wouldn't say they're terribly common, but they are in use, and they're more in use commercially. I mean, we see them commercially in higher end buildings, and of course, there's buildings, labs and things that really have to actively work on the air quality. But it really depends on what you're trying to keep out of the space and out of the house. I mean, the fresh air issue that I bring up is usually as much for an efficient way to get nice temperatures. I mean, here's an example. It is, I'm in Champaign right now. I know you're up in Chicago.
Yeah.
This morning, let's see, about an hour ago, I walked out of the house. It's, I don't know, 58 degrees, 60 degrees, 62 right. or something. It's beautiful here. And the person next to me, the house next to me, has two air conditioning units. It's a duplex. Both of them were running as I walked past the house an hour ago.
Are they on air conditioning or just ventilating?
They're on air conditioning. They're condensing units. Mm-hmm. And I've heard them running on Thanksgiving.
Well, I'm near the outer drive, and I could see a million cars going by every day, and all that exhaust gas.
Okay. You have other issues then.
Yeah, that's the building we had. There's a big blower on the roof, blows fresh air into the halls and under the door.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that air seems, they change the filter occasionally, but if they could clean up the smoke from the cars, it's something else.
Every 10 years, whether it needs it or not. Okay, right. so you have an interesting issue that we down here in little old Champaign Urbana don't have to deal with very often.
Oh, and another thing, when you turn on your furnace or your burner, doesn't that suck in air from the outside and cause all kinds of drafts by wherever the air is coming in? Feed that flame?
It depends on the unit. A lot of residential units are unlike commercial systems. A lot of residential units, most residential units, don't pull in. Well, they don't pull in outside air to deliver to the space. They do require air for combustion, and generally, the newer high efficiency units will have a little pipe going outside that sucks the air in, takes it right to the burner, so you don't have to heat it up in your house first before you burn it. But as far as ventilation air. That's really not. It's sort of just considered an accidental benefit that you do. Houses, and nowadays as we build houses tighter and tighter, this is becoming more of an issue that people are actually controlling the amount of ventilation they put in their houses with air to air heat exchangers and different technologies.
I've heard it said that the air in the house is cleaner than the air outside in some cases.
Sounds like where you live, it sure is.
Yeah, that's the problem.
Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for the call.
That was interesting.
We're past our midpoint already with Larry Lister. He's an engineer with Facility Dynamics Engineering, talking about home energy and taking your questions. We have a couple people waiting, and time for others if you'd like to join us. The number around Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free anywhere else, 800-222-9455. A listener in Southern Illinois next on line number two. Good morning.
Hi, Larry. Could you talk a little bit about insulating or a crawl space? What's the best to do there?
I'm going to give you the engineer's answer. It depends. It's kind of the issues with a crawl space. The big question becomes where do you want to define your temperature barrier? There's along the walls of the crawl space, or there's the floor of the house. Are sort of the two main decisions that you have, and which one is correct just depends on it can depend on a lot of things, and generally a contractor that you might have in would be the best one to help you make that determination. Generally speak, I don't know. I've seen it. I've really seen it go both ways. There's some research going on. I know that. Rose here on campus,
Bill Rose.
Bill Rose, who does a lot of this kind of research, is looking at. They're always finding really interesting things about how to do what and where. And again, I'm not able to follow all of that as it occurs. But generally speaking, you've got to decide whether you're going to do the floor so that the crawl space is ventilated and in the winter cold, or whether you're going to do the side so that that area is warmer. Usually the main consideration is plumbing, mm-hmm. is where's your plumbing, how's that going? The other decision could be where is your furnace? Is the furnace ducted through the crawl space, or is it ducted overhead in the attic?
We have an outside wood-burning boiler.
Oh, okay.
And the plumbing is just in one small
spot. So you have hot water. You have hot water heat?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So as long as that piping is insulated, that kind of takes that piece out of the mm-hmm. out of the equation. Some of it also just comes down to how easy it is to insulate.
Very hard. It's very short. I don't know. Maybe 4 feet, 3 feet in some spots.
Yeah.
Crawl under.
Yeah, it might. Some of it just comes down to practical issues like that, where you might be better off trying to insulate the sides, and the crawl space then becomes a tempered area where, in the winter, you're never going to insulate it perfectly because you've got the ground to deal with. Although the ground will kind of set itself up also with its own. At some point you're going to be paying for some heat to heat the ground underneath. But it's going to all reach a steady state at some point, and then.
But we were told to definitely put poly down on the ground.
Yeah, I think that's generally the. Although I think I've been hearing some negatives on that too. But it gets into water issues and mold, and I know there are ways to treat the ground prior to putting poly down. I think in general that's the way I would approach it, but. Again, that's another thing. There should be a lot online. You could probably get on and
what would I look under for that?
Insulating crawl spaces or something. There's so many great do-it-yourself sites and sites that have helpful information. I mean, always like anything you do online, look at the source of the information. If it's somebody selling something, you've got to look at it with a much more critical eye than if it's a Department of Energy site that's just trying. There's a lot of great things out there. The Department of Energy is doing a lot of good things online. There's also books like the Consumer Guide to Home Energy Savings, which you can get. They update that every year. It's put out by the American Council for an Energy Efficient Economy. Any bookstore, Borders, or any of those places, you can find things like that. It's a really useful.
If I was to do just the wall perimeters, the blue... insulation,
the blue board.
Blue board.
Yeah, that stuff that works pretty well, and that gives you that where the blue board exists, that you're not going to be pulling air through that, because that's pretty impermeable to having air move through it. Whenever you use anything rigid, however, you need to make sure that you go along and hit the gaps and places where there are gaps. Either with some kind of a good construction tape, or some of these these canned foams are pretty useful for, and those also hold up to pressure, so that you don't have a lot of the infiltration issue, because at that point you want to line up that temperature barrier being the insulation with
continuous
the pressure barrier being where air can be sucked through. And I mean, anytime you're doing any of this, just assume that somehow there's going to be air on one side and air on another, and see if you were air, where would you go?
Okay.
Kind of the Chief Seattle approach
to
insulating.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
We could make fun of that for a while.
Oh, we could.
I also wanted to mention for resources that people might contact the Building Research Council at the University of Illinois.
Oh, yeah, great resource.
Because you mentioned Bill Rose does research there, and so do others, and they're they're pretty pretty consumer-friendly.
Oh, there's some great folks out there. Don Fournier is a great resource out that way. And yeah, it's we're lucky in Illinois to have those guys.
Good. A couple callers waiting. We'll go next to an Urbana listener, line number 3. Good morning.
Hi.
Yes.
We're in a ranch-style home that's probably about 14 years old. We've been here for 3 years now. Is there a ballpark figure in terms of the life expectancy of the furnace?
Depends on the furnace, but yeah, there is. And it depends on how often it runs and, you know, how often you use it, how many hours you put on it.
Okay, this is a train furnace, and we've had it serviced every year since we've been here. And they're suggesting now that, well, yeah, it's probably maybe lived its life expectancy, and we should be looking at a new one.
Yeah, unfortunately, back in the 70s and 80s, the furnaces that were going in were probably less robust than they were prior to that. Although they were more efficient, they were kind of less robust than they were prior to that. Or since the newer ones, I think, are going to have better longevity than some of these older ones. Although you've got the computer circuitry thing to deal with.
But one other question too, and the statement has been made that the furnace that we have is larger than it needs to be.
Good point. That's really common.
Is it common?
Oh yeah, and okay. It's so common that it's not hard to make a statement that when you're going to replace it, don't replace it with the same size.
Okay,
because they almost always just overdo it. And how you can tell is as you get through the winters, you get into the really cold weather in the winter. See how often you sense that thing cycling, because a lot of times if you have a furnace that's, say, 100,000 BTUs per hour, which is considered a pretty big residential furnace, and that thing comes on and it's on for maybe 5 to 7 minutes and it shuts off again, and then it comes on again. Well, if it keeps coming on and off and on and off, that tells you that your house is inefficient. But when it comes on, if it's able to do the job quickly and then shut off, and it keeps cycling, That's a pretty good sign that you're too large. Now, people that listen to the show fairly regularly when I'm on are, you know, hear me harp in the spring about air conditioners and not having air conditioners oversized. It's a bigger sin to oversize an air conditioner than it is a furnace.
Okay.
Furnaces handle it better. At least you don't get as big a penalty on efficiency. But you do get a penalty on efficiency, and you know.
So in this case, smaller is better. Well,
too small is too small.
Size is better than too big, right?
In the case of a furnace, a little too big is better than a little too small.
Okay.
I will say that. In the case of an air conditioner, the opposite is true. A little too small is better than a little too big.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Thanks very much for the call. A couple callers also holding. We'll go next to a listener on a cell phone on line number one. Good morning.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I was wanting to know what's the most efficient kind of furnace that's available now to put into an existing home?
I'm assuming you're talking furnace being a forced air type unit.
Well, I mean, if a person were just to start from scratch, I mean, I've even looked at doing the installing the radiant floor heating with the plastic tubing kind of thing, too. I mean, is that something? I kind of wonder about putting, you know, holes in every one of my floor joists. I don't know if that's truly realistic or not, but I don't know if it's the main concern or not. But
well,
kind of a heating system.
Yeah, if you have an existing house, uh-huh. that's gonna really kind of limit how. I mean, you can do anything, obviously. Mm-hmm. If you're building a new house, it's a whole different decision than if you're trying to do an existing house. To do in-floor heating, which I love and is really efficient and is wonderful for a whole bunch of different reasons, there's a couple downsides to it. But if you're looking to do that to an existing home, really tough, almost impossible. Mm-hmm. As much as I'd love to tell you to do it, it just you'd have to really want to throw some money at the problem.
Uh-huh.
If you've got a forced air furnace with ductwork around the house and you just want to replace an existing unit, the way to go, and this is the standard technology nowadays, but it's good and they work pretty well, is you want a 90%+ efficient condensing furnace.
Okay.
And as you're pricing that, and they go up to 95%, 96%, although really where you are in the 90s is not such a big deal. What you do want is to make sure that it's sealed combustion,
oh.
Which means that there will be two very low cost, easy to install plastic pipes going into and out of the house.
Right.
Where the because the furnace needs air from outside, and in this case you're dedicating a little pipe to sucking the cold air right into the burner, and then you're blowing that air back out the side of the house, usually in a different location, but some of them are at the same location. They have an interesting little fitting that works real well. And so you put one hole in the house or two holes, you know, sort of close to each other. You pull in the air and you blow out the air. You no longer need to worry about your chimney and all the maintenance and things associated with chimneys and chimney linings and all that stuff. You can also do the same technology exists now for hot water heaters.
Yeah.
So I fully recommend just going to that place. Back in the early 90s and late 80s, it was a new technology and there were some problems and some things happened. And a lot of the old timers are still saying, "Ah, you don't want to do that. You don't want to do that." But it's
what about also? I've heard of geothermal or water furnaces. I mean, what actually is a water furnace? Or one thing, but
that one would get into a little bit of issue, but and you can go on and research it. But the general idea there is that heat pumps are is a single unit that runs in two directions. It heats in the summer or it heats in the winter, cools in the summer.
Right.
The most efficient way for a heat pump to work, and it uses a refrigerant as the working fluid within internal to that system.
Right.
What the fact that it's using a refrigerant loop, it's able to make heat and make cooling. Well, my engineering professors would kill me for talking like that. You can make hot and make cold by running this thing in two different directions. And in the summer, you're taking and we try to use the ground or there's you can use the air as the rejection place. You know, just dump it to the atmosphere.
Right.
You can put a ground loop in, which allows you to use a fairly constant temperature, 55, 60 degree, 70 degree, depending on the season. Reservoir being the ground as the source for dumping your heat or your cooling,
right,
depending on what you need to do. Or if you have a lake nearby, a pond, you can stick it down. Those are called water source. There's other technologies as well where you use well water to come up and do some things. But in general, if you bury a big old slinky loop in the ground, you're using this relatively constant temperature source in the winter to help you heat, and then you're using the same source to help you cool.
But it wouldn't necessarily be any more efficient than the 90 plus with
this. They're efficient. They're definitely more efficient. They're more efficient on a year round basis. The problem is they're expensive. The technology's great, and it's efficient, and it's a wonderful way to do the job. You generally need some land, or you're going to tear up your backyard if you want to put the slinky in. If you're building new, it's another one of those deals, not quite as bad as the hydronic in-floor, but if you're building new, your options are a lot better than they are. If you're in a little house down here on Stoughton Street in Urbana, kind of tough to force fit that technology into the mix.
We just moved into this home, and our previous house, even though it had a gravity flow furnace in it, I had put a vent-free gas heater in the basement to keep the pipes warm down there, and it also kept the floors warm.
Oh, good. Yeah.
And we didn't end up turning the furnace on until like into January a lot of times because it just was comfortable enough. And now my family is complaining because we have a modern home now and they don't like the cold floors. So I thought about doing that, you know, radiant floor heating, or at least buying something more efficient so they can run it more often to appease them. But I don't know. We'll have to see what.
Yeah, and the other thing to look into is maybe seeing if there's something else causing those floors to be colder than they should be. And floors are always going to be kind of cold, you know. But
And it's pretty well insulated too, in the crawl space and so on. But it's mostly hardwood floors, and it just tends to be cool, I guess. I'm not too sure.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you, sir.
Okay, no problem.
Thanks for the call. We have about 7 minutes left with Larry Lister from Facility Dynamics Engineering taking your questions about home energy. We have one caller waiting and probably time for others if you'd like to join us. Champaign-Urbana number 333-9455. Toll-free elsewhere 800-222-9455. Champaign listener next on line number two. Good morning.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Hi.
My question isn't really about home heating so much as heating for a shop, space, a woodworking shop space that's used intermittently. Basically, I have 1,200 square feet with a very high ceiling and more or less minimal insulation, but I only use that space a week or two seriously in a month. So my general strategy has been to create a well-insulated subspace where I keep all my perishables and heat that with a forced air non-vented propane heater. If I should start to use the space more, it's been suggested to me that the radiant style propane heater like you see in an auto mechanic shop would be the way to go. And I wondered if you could comment as to, for intermittent use, adding or replacing what I have now with the radiant style would be a cost-effective way to go.
Yeah, radiant is often cost-effective, depending on whether you're using electricity or natural gas. The big deal with radiant, just to understand, is that it does not heat the air. I mean, there's going to be a little bit of accidental heating, but radiant is meant to heat your body. And if as soon as you're out of the line of sight of that radiant source, you're going to be cold. And any object that is outside the line of sight of that radiant source is not going to be nearly as warm as whatever, you know, whether you're dealing with wood or whatever your, you know, the material is that's in there, is going to be cold. So you're going to have some pretty big temperature fluctuations. And so now, depending on if you're doing real high-end millwork and using cherry and all kinds of, you know, really nice materials, that could be an issue for you. If it's just creature comfort you're more worried about, then that would probably work out pretty well. The other thing to do is just to do, you know, what a lot of shops do is these big old hanging natural gas or propane, you know, Reznor kind of big old heater with a blower on it. It's not a real efficient technology, but if you're not in there all that much, that's a way to go too.
Hope that helps. We've got several callers and we'll go next to an Urbana listener on line number one. Good morning.
Hi, this isn't about a house in Urbana. This is about an addition to a farmhouse that the family owns out in Ohio, and I've called about this place before. There's an addition to the house. It's on a crawl space, and it's built on clay soils that are often saturated, and there's a slight long slope toward the house, and since we tend not to be there much and not to look in the crawl space, it's taken us a while to realize that the freezing, presumably, of the soils, of the waterlogged soils, has cracked the foundation, pushing it in. And we're going to have somebody, and we've arranged for somebody to come and redo the foundation, do a trench around it to sidetrack the water that's getting in there and take it out. And my husband and I put down plastic. There had been some plastic, but it was all covered with crud. And the soil underneath was just saturated. Mm-hmm. My question that came up from an earlier caller was, there's also a sump pump in there. The sump pump is going to presumably be less necessary when we're going to intercept this water before it gets to the house. But I'm concerned in thinking about insulating the walls. You talked about thinking about whether there was plumbing. The only plumbing in this space is the sump pump. And I was just wondering whether you have to worry about sump pumps in unheated crawl spaces freezing in the wintertime. So that would affect where we insulate. At the moment, nothing is insulated there because we were trying to figure out what to do. So any advice?
Boy, that's a lot of it depends calls today. You know, the crawl space issues are just so dependent on, you know, specifics and things. Although you did a pretty good job describing what you had. In general, anytime you have plumbing, you don't know how often that thing's going to be needed. I realize, but I'd say try to protect it.
So we should really insulate the walls and not ventilate the space in the wintertime.
That would be my gut take. Not being, it's like trying to diagnose a patient over the phone, but based on what you told me, I think I'd probably go that direction.
I have another question for you.
Okay.
There's a barn, and with downspouts that go into the ground, and they drain through a long underground pipe out to the creek. It doesn't make any sense to me that these downspout drains would work when you have the ground freeze, presumably the water in the downspout freezes and would clog up. But nobody believes me. They say, well, it always works. My point is nobody's really watched to find out whether it works or not in those conditions. What's your thought about when you have downspouts going into the ground in places that where the ground freezes?
Yeah, not something I know a lot about, although I think that if there was water in there and it was freezing, you'd be getting bursting and stuff. So it may be that if it seems to be working all right, it's good. That'd be a Hank question right there, though, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I forgot who I was talking to. I just kind of got. It just suddenly occurred to me that this question. I always forget to ask this question with Hank. Hank is on. I have a feeling that there's a question back there I need to ask. Sorry.
Yeah. Okay.
I'll get off and let somebody else.
Okay.
Thanks
for the call. We'll try squeezing one last caller, line number 4, McLean County. Good morning.
Oh, good morning. My question is about water heaters. We, I think, have now a gas water heater, and you know, I hear about those. On-demand water heaters for a large house, maybe 2,000 square feet. I mean, not that the size matters, actually. We have a couple showers and dishwasher and washing machine stuff, equivalent to 30-gallon water heater. What do you think about those? Are they really efficient? Are they worth having? Or upside, downside, and where one can find one of those things?
Yeah. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of them, as far as I've never used one. I do recall in the 90s, there when I was at the construction research lab, we did some research on it, and they were not as effective as they needed to be. You know, people were not happy with them. I think we actually put a bunch in some army housing, so we used those folks as guinea pigs. But they work all. I mean, technically they sort of work all right, but in general, I don't think it's where they are right now. You know, I don't really know. I know that there are still people selling them, but it sounds like the last thing I recall reading on it from people that deal with this stuff all the time, HomeEnergy.com is another good place to go.
Okay,
for, Home Energy Magazine. You can search on some of these things because they really keep up with a lot of these new technologies. But in general, I think the deal is that they're useful for certain types of situations where you don't use hot water regularly, you don't need much of it, and you know, you just need it on a little like a remote location away from where you can get hot water in your house. If you add an addition, can't get hot water. I think they're kind of specialty items. I would go with more of a traditional hot water.
Peter. Hope that gets to the caller's question. We're out of time, and we left a lot of callers that we didn't get to. Want to go for
one of them might have been my mom.
Should we go for another hour?
She was threatening to call. Yeah, let's just keep going.
Oh, sure. Okay. No, actually, we can't. We got to stop. That's the end of Focus for the day. Our guest has been Larry Lister with Facility Dynamics Engineering, and I'm sure we'll have you back again. We'll twist your arm and get you back here in the studio. And thanks so much, Larry.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Champaign